That was a little bit of Herbs in a Glass from trumpeter Jason Palmer, with Mark Turner on tenor sax, Matt Brewer on bass, and Kendrick Scott on drums. Jason Palmer is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast, part of the Osiris Network. Visit osirispod.com to check out some of the more than 24 other shows they host on a broad range of topics. And if you want to support Burning Ambulance directly, please go to patreon.com/burningambulance and become a subscriber. For $5 a month, you get exclusive content, including custom Spotify playlists assembled by me, the occasional subscriber-only episode, and whatever else I can think of. Plus, you get to support Burning Ambulance, which has been going since 2010 without any advertising or other external revenue sources, so every little bit helps, believe me. Anyway, as I said, this episode features an interview with trumpeter Jason Palmer, who should be much better known than he is. I think part of that is because he's not based in New York. He works in Boston because he teaches at Berkeley, and he performs weekly at Wally's, a little jazz club up there. He's been doing that residency in one form or another for close to 20 years. And last year, he released two live CDs, Live at Wally's Volume 1 and 2, on the Steeplechase label. He's been recording for them for about a decade, and has done some really interesting work, including albums of Minnie Riperton and Janelle Monáe songs, and he's got another one in that series of tribute albums on the way this year, which he talks about in this interview. He's also an actor, or he was once. Palmer starred in Damien Chazelle's first movie, Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. Now, Chazelle is kind of a controversial figure in jazz circles because of his movies Whiplash and La La Land, which portray a version of jazz that a lot of fans and critics can't really relate to say the least. So we talked about that a little bit, too. Palmer's latest album is Rhyme and Reason. It's a double CD recorded live at the Jazz Gallery in New York with the help of Giant Step Arts, a nonprofit started by photographer Jimmy Katz and his wife Dina. They've chosen a few artists whose work they want to support and offered them the money to record albums, with Jimmy engineering the music and shooting the photos. And when it's all done, the musicians own it. They can license it to a label, they can sell it themselves, they can do whatever they want with it, and after 2 years, they even own the masters. It's a pretty amazing deal. I'm going to play one more piece of music now. This is a little bit of Waltz for Diana, which is another track from Rhyme and Reason, and after that, you'll hear my conversation with Jason Palmer. Thank you.
You're originally from North Carolina, right?
Yeah, I was born and raised in High Point, North Carolina, the furniture capital of the world, as they're affectionately known.
And when and how did you move to Massachusetts, as a kid or as an adult?
No, I moved in 1997 to attend New England Conservatory for
Okay.
music, and that's where I studied.
Yeah, I know some people up there. Who did you study with over there?
Well, John McNeil was my main teacher. He taught me everything I know about the trumpet, pretty much. He and Danilo Perez and Bob Moses, Cecil McBee, Jerry Braganzi. Yeah, at that school, you're still able to study with a person of a different instrument. And so every semester, I would have a different teacher, and then every other week, I would have a lesson with McNeil, and then a lesson with Braganzi, or lesson with McNeil, and one with Cecil McBee. So yeah, a lot of teachers there were instrumental in my development.
And when did you graduate there?
2001.
And how old were you when you originally picked up the trumpet? Was that your first instrument?
Yeah, it was my first instrument. I started out on cornet. My mother bought a cornet for me, thinking it was a trumpet. So I started out on cornet, and I switched to trumpet in high school. So I was about 11, 12 years old when I started. I wasn't really serious. I didn't get serious until I moved to Boston, actually, where I started to really dedicate myself to playing. And that came after seeing Nicholas Payton and Roy Hargrove at a master class with the Kendrick Oliver New Life Jazz Orchestra, which also had Jeremy Pelton and Rashawn Ross in the trumpet section.
Wow.
And I saw all four of them playing, and it really struck a chord with me to see them playing in a, they played in a clinic, and then they gave a concert later. And that's when I started to really turn it around and say, I want to dedicate my life to this instrument. So.
Now, for the average person, what is the difference between the cornet and the trumpet?
Well, the cornet it looks shorter, and it has a conical bore, which means the bore, the tubing that you blow into and out of, is shaped like a cone. So the air travels at a different rate than in through a trumpet. And so cornets are more known for parades and marches and everything. But I mean, there have been great cornetists in the history of jazz music, like Nat Adderley, and so yeah. I mean, there's not much of a difference in the way they play. They both have three, traditionally have three valves, and they're in the same key. But yeah, I started out on that, and I think it was good for me because my hands were smaller and I was a smaller person, so it was easier to carry it around in a case. I had a cute little case for it, so it's probably a blessing.
Have you ever played a what do they call it that Stephen Bernstein plays, the slide trumpet?
Oh, slide trumpet? No, I haven't played one of those. Those are cool, though. I'd like to get my hands on one.
To me, when I'm listening to your playing, your sound is very precise with relatively few kind of smeared notes or kind of drifting phrases. So, I mean, what are your goals for yourself as a player, and what are you trying to achieve? Are you about, are you focused on that kind of like precise articulation and stuff like that?
Not necessarily. It depends on what context I'm in. I've been lucky to play in a lot of different bands that, call for different approaches to the instrument. The other side of your description is some of my work I've done with Montanaa Roberts out of the AACM. That's where I've tried to, do more things with the possibilities of the sound of the trumpet, and I'm not quite as deep as I'd like to be, because I don't have that many opportunities to play with people of her caliber. But I think all in all, recently, I mean, I've been playing in groups where I want to tell a story and have things be really clear, especially in my improvisations. And so, yeah, that it comes from all the people I've checked out, throughout the career, transcribing a lot of players who have that characteristic in their sound. You know, I think it resonated with me early on in my development in college.
And who really were the who were the players that were speaking to you when you were like a young guy?
I was checking out a lot of Freddie Hubbard, Booker Little, Clifford Brown, Kenny Durham. A lot of my contemporaries. I met Sean Jones in the early 2000s. Him and Ambrose Akinmusiri was a dear friend of mine. But yeah, just checking those players out and trying to pick little devices from them and trying to envelop them into my own style and maybe develop some things that they did. And so I think it's always an ongoing process for me to make those ideas and my own ideas as clear on the instrument. And that's a big challenge. I mean, it's not easy to do that on particularly a brass instrument like the trumpet.
Do you think that there was a certain point at which you could feel your own voice kind of developing and you were like, all right, I'm getting there, you know?
I mean, it's been a long, it's a long process. I think I understood that it was it's going to be a long process. I've had a bunch of mentors along the way, you know, give me some guidance, let me know that, you know, it takes a long time for you to sound like yourself, but you just have to kind of trust the process and learn as much as you can, try to learn something new every day. I remember there was one moment I'll never forget. I was in a practice room at school. I was out of school by then. I was teaching at NEC. I taught in the prep school there for a while, and I was there one particular Saturday, and one of my students didn't show up, so I just practiced in that time, and someone knocks on the door, and I open the door, and it's Billy Hart, and he says, "Hey, man," I had never met him at that time. It was the first time meeting him. I knew who he was. He said, "Hey, man, I hear what you're saying. You're getting towards the truth, man." And I said, "Okay, thank you." I don't know what to say about that, but I'm really flattered and honored that you take the time to, you know, knock on the door and you know, say something like that. So, I mean, yeah, I think it's important to do the work, to learn the language through the people who spoke it, but also try to learn the way that you're going to write within that language. So I've did a lot of work just recording myself practicing and analyzing what I was playing, you know, taking out the things that I liked and, you know, trying to make notes on the things I wanted to improve upon and composing that way. I started composing the same way, just recording myself and extracting little phrases that I thought would work for a tune. So yeah, it's been a long process. It's ongoing, and I don't know if I'll ever see the end of the road, and that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even Sonny Rollins said, like, at 80 something, you know, that he was still, you know, says, I think I'm getting there. Mm-hmm. You know, so how long have you been teaching at Berklee?
I've been there for almost 10 years now. I taught in public schools for about 13, 14 years. And I taught in a prep school at NEC, the preparatory school, and the School of Continuing Education for about 12 or 13 years.
Mm-hmm. And what exactly do you teach? Are you one-on-one with trumpet students? Do you lead ensembles? Like, how does it work? What, you know?
Yeah, my official title at Berklee is a assistant professor of ensembles. So most of my work at the school is directing small jazz ensembles. I have a mixed styles ensemble. We play different styles, but I think four or five of my other groups are all small group jazz. I also teach a jazz repertoire class and the jazz improv techniques class. And then I have a handful of one-on-one trumpet students.
And with the jazz repertory class, what is in the repertory at this point? Is it all still tunes from like the 30s and 40s, or how, you know, are you bringing in new music, or, you know, like relatively new music? Like, what, you know, what is the evolution of the jazz repertoire and standards and stuff like that in your mind?
Yeah, and at Berklee, they have several levels. They have Jazz Rep 1, Jazz Rep 2. So every semester, I usually teach the Jazz Rep 1 class, and in that class, I'll get students who may not know many tunes, they may not know any standards. But what I try to do is split up the semester with, I teach them riff tunes, like simple tunes that have a riff that they can learn, that they can play at a jam session. So there's a list of about 20 of those tunes, and then we either spend the rest of the semester learning Thelonious Monk tunes, so we learn those, or we learn this semester we're focusing on Wayne Shorter songs. They're up to about about the fifth or sixth week now. I think we're up to about 20 of his songs, just playing through them and analyzing the structures and the harmonies and the forms and the melodies, and just learning the history of him too, which is pretty eye-opening to a lot of the students who don't know much about Wayne. So yeah, I try to switch it up every semester to kind of keep it fresh, because I have some students that take the class again. They might know songs. I usually start off the semester finding out how many songs they know. I have them write out what tunes they know, and then kind of go from there. And then some semesters I just focus on ballads, like a lot of ballads, or just waltzes. And I have a master list of tunes that every working jazz musician should be able to know, function in the jam session setting. So a lot of standards, all the way up until, Wayne's written output from the 60s.
Yeah. What's your take on the recent upheavals at Berkeley? Like, how has the school changed in the last few years in your mind?
You mean with it's all kind of things have been happening. You mean the faculty members who've been outed and
yeah, that kind of stuff. How has that changed the atmosphere, do you think?
I think Berkeley's trying to become a lot more transparent with how things work and how things are handled, which is high time that's come to light. So I think that's a good thing. There's a few new organizations that have formed. I know Terry Lane Carrington is heading up a organization for jazz and gender justice, which is a wonderful organization within the school. And I think it's all needed. I think a lot of, especially in this like male-centered jazz, culture, we need, especially the young ones, we need to have a lot more understanding of the privilege that we all have, and how we can be more equitable in the way that we deal with inclusion and diversity in the music and in the culture. So. And it starts in the schools too.
Have you seen it sort of manifesting in the way the students treat each other, or the way bands form and things like that? Like, is it having an on the ground effect in that sense?
There's an organ. I don't know if it's a student run organization or a faculty led organization, but they've started having female-led jam sessions in Boston. There's one at a place called Virtuosity. They have, I think, maybe once a month or so. I don't know if that came out of Berkeley or came out of the Boston community, but I've seen that happen. And, in my classes, I haven't really had to deal with that. I think I haven't had any of that kind of, I don't let that kind of thing grow in my environment. So, me personally, I haven't had to deal with that kind of thing. But the school, they've, in a few of the buildings, they've put windows in the doors that didn't have windows. It's those kind of little things that can help, help students feel safe in that space. So.
Yeah. And you also teach at Harvard, right? What's your role there?
Yeah, I taught at Harvard for a semester. I filled in for Vijay Iyer
Oh, okay.
He took a sabbatical, mm-hmm. and that was about 2 years ago. And so I filled in for him in a creative music seminar that he taught.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And some talented musicians there, too.
So let's talk about your playing. You have a long working relationship with Noah Preminger. So, because I've seen his name on a lot of your records and stuff like that. So tell me how you two started playing together and what you think makes your voices, you know, trumpet and saxophone, complementary.
Yeah, well, I initially met Noah when he was an undergrad at NEC. When he was studying there, I was pretty much living there because my wife was the director of student life. And so we lived on campus, and that was the gig. She was the overlooked the dorms and the student activities. And so, and I was also teaching in the prep school at the time. So I was still in the environment. So I met him when he was studying there. I'm about 8 years older than him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we played at various sessions, and we played on a few recitals together. And that's when I initially met him. And then when he finished his undergrad, he moved, I believe, to New York first, or maybe to Spain. I can't remember. So I didn't see him for many years after that, maybe 5-6 years. And then he came back to Boston to do his master's at NEC. And that's when we started playing a lot. Initially, I think he had called me to do a recording or some gigs, and just kind of snowballed from there.
Mm-hmm.
So I played on, let's see, maybe four. We did a crisscross one. We did two crisscross ones, and we did a live one, and then we did one at a studio down the street from my house. So, yeah, at least four recordings that are out or coming out now. And he played on my Live at Wally's double disc that I put out last year. And so, I mean, his tenor playing, he's really easy to play with. I mean, his sound, he's got a... like a bulldoze. He's got a huge sound, but he controls it very well. I mean, his intonation is impeccable, and he's got big ears too. I mean, even on my compositions, he plays in a way where he'll phrase things in a way that I actually play them that might not be listed on the score. So he picks up on these little things, and he never forgets them. He has this kind of really cool musical memory when we're playing together in unison on a lot of things, and he's got the range of an alto. You know, he's got a really nice upper register on his instrument, so it's really easy to write for, really fun to conceive things for him to play when I'm composing for two horns.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I've tried to develop an ability to adapt to different horn players' sounds. You know, I've kind of spent, I don't know, the past past 15 years playing with a lot of two-horn frontline bands. Like my first big break, what you could call a break, is when I was playing with Greg Osby.
Mm.
So I learned a lot about playing, you know, with two horns and phrasing and everything from touring with him for a couple of years. And then I played with Grace Kelly's band for over 10 years. And we did a lot of touring with her and Phil Woods and Lee Konitz. And so I learned a lot about, you know, how to breathe together and phrase together and cut notes off. And, you know, the things you learn in big band, you know, it's tough to play a lot with other horn players in a big band because there's not much work in a big band. So I got... you know, a lot of that stuff through playing small groups with two horns on the front line.
Yeah, yeah. Another guy that you work with a lot that I've seen on the credits to a lot of your records is Lee Fish, a drummer. And I don't know about him. As far as I know, I've only heard him on your records. So what can you tell me about him and your relationship as players?
Oh, he's my brother. Out of all the musicians I've played and recorded with, I've played with him the longest, I think. And so we're going back maybe 12, 13, 14 years. I can't even remember the first time I playing. It was sometime in like 2003 or something, and we played together every weekend, two nights a week, from there until now. And he recently moved to New York, and so people are starting to hear about him now.
Okay.
I mean, but he's been playing a lot outside of the Boston area too. But I think people are really going to start to pick up, you know, this new talent since he moved to New York. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he's a great composer too. You know, drummers write really interesting things, and I think he's one of them. And yeah, he's got a great touch. He's really dynamic and sensitive, and he can play any style pretty much. He grew up, his mother and father were both musicians, and he was homeschooled, so he grew up on the road, and they had a family band together.
Oh, okay.
And so okay. So yeah, he. You know, there's pictures of him 3-4 years old playing the drum set. So he really grew up in music. He's from the Boston area, from Stoneham.
Mm.
But yeah, he's played on many of my records. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Billy Hart earlier, and you actually made a record with him, and it was mostly like standards and repertoire pieces, but then there were two new pieces on the record, and one of them was yours. So was that... Were you surprised that he pulled one of your compositions for the recording? Like, how did that whole date come about?
Yeah, that was a big surprise, because that was a session that he put together for Steeplechase. And at the time, I wasn't on Steeplechase. That was the first record session I had that was affiliated with that label. And going into the session, Billy wanted to do a set of Eric Dolphy tunes, maybe. So he asked us to bring in arrangements. So I arranged a couple of tunes on that record. And at the end of the session, Niels, the producer on the label, the owner of the label, said, you know, I don't think we have enough music. Do you have any other tunes? Maybe we could have one or two tunes. And so Billy looked around and said, does anybody have any tunes? And I happen to have a tune in my case. And I was like, yeah, let's play this one. So we just read it down. They played it. And that was that. And afterwards, Niels approached me and said, would you consider, you know, recording for Steeplechase? And I said, sure. And so that was my introduction to, you know, recording for Steeplechase. And it was on that session that Billy Hart put together.
Wow. Yeah. And you've done a bunch of records for them now, like...
Yeah, about 10 records. Yeah, I got one coming out later this year. It's my last one for them. And it's the music of Anita Baker.
Oh,
we actually recorded that in December of 2017.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's coming out.
So you mentioned also Matana Roberts. How did you get invited to participate in her project, her Coin project?
Yeah, we were at NEC at the same time, so we knew each other from school, and I actually heard her before she got to the school, because she used to come and visit her then boyfriend at the time at NEC. And when she comes, she practices in the practice rooms. And I just camp out outside of her practice room, because I was really mesmerized by her sound. And then she enrolled in the school, and we started playing in a few ensembles together. And we played a couple of gigs outside of the school together, and then she put together Coin and asked me to join, and that was that. We've done a couple of tours. We did a record that came out on LP. I think it's on CD too. Mississippi Moonchild.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned so much from her just through the creative inspirational tools that she kind of channels through the AACM. Like, a lot of things she taught me about in ensemble interaction I use in my jazz improv techniques class at Berkeley. So she's a big influence on me. I really looked up to her since I met her.
The whole project is so fascinating to me, because the music goes in so many different directions from album to album, and then it has this sort of conceptual underpinning that runs through the whole project, you know.
It's
going to be a you know, whenever she continues it's going to be just a massive work, you know. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So You said you've got the next record you're doing is an Anita Baker tribute, which is the third of those that you've done, because you did the Minnie Riperton one and the Janelle Monáe one. And
yep.
Those, I think, are very interesting, too, because both on a musical level and also just because by their existence, they kind of point out the schism that's been set up between jazz and R&B, which is kind of a false divide in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, I mean, talk a little bit about those projects, you know, and what you're doing with them.
Yeah, well, with all three of them, the one thing that I did was I kept all the melodic content that the singers used in their songs intact. And then on some of the songs, I would change up the meter. Like, I'd make a song instead of being in 4/4, it's in 7/4 or 9/4 or even in a mixed meter. So I changed up the rhythms a bit and used those tunes. I used all of those tunes as vehicles for improvisation. So that's like the short term, the short form answer to that. And so I wanted it to be something where, you know, the average person who knows Anita Baker's songs could listen to that and know what that song is, which is, I guess, the thing that you would hope for if it's going to be an Anita Baker project in the first place. But I really tried to stay true in that case, and also in Janelle Monáe's case, and then Minnie Riperton project. So, yeah, I just tried to make them be like true vehicles for creative expression for the song. So
yeah. I think it's also interesting especially with the Minnie Riperton record, because in the white world, Minnie Riperton is a one-hit wonder. There's Loving You and that's it, you know. But to talk a little bit about her sort of actual musical legacy and what drew you to make a whole record of her tunes.
Oh, geez, yeah. She, I knew Loving You, but I think the first tunes that really caught my attention was finding out that her voice was sampled in the Tribe Called Quest CD, Midnight Marauders. The tune that she did, Inside My Love,
mm-hmm.
That tune was sampled. And when I heard how that was sampled, I researched the history of that song and to find out that it was banned from radio because it was too risque. And I was like, who is this artist doing all this really, you know, provocative music? And so I dug in deeper to her work, and then I found out about the Rotary Connection. And then I started to get deeper into her actual albums, and I found such a diverse set of music coming from her albums. I mean, she had tunes that were in certain keys that would just modulate to here and there. I was like, man, where did all these ideas come from? For, you know, I had never really heard someone's music, you know, have so many turns and things, and have this beautiful voice sailing above everything. So I said, you know, I got to see what I can do with this music. And so then I just talked to my parents, and they, you know, they knew her records and everything. And then I found out more about her life, and it just really touched me about, you know, her whole legacy and her passing. She was one of the first celebrities to really come out publicly about her bout with breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not many celebrities were coming out and talking about that in various talk shows and stuff, but she was one of the first to talk about that kind of thing. And she passed away the year I was born, so I kind of feel this kind of dark connection to her too.
Ah, okay. Yeah. I mean, it's again, like I say, you know, she's kind of someone who's sort of hidden in a way, you know, like the music is there, but it's not revived as much as, you know, it might necessarily deserve to be, you know.
Yeah.
The album that you did, the Sudoku Suite, which was put together for a commission, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The track titles, in part, they spell out the phrase "obsessive compulsive disorder is now under control thanks to the guidance of fun and games." Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, geez, yeah. Yeah, I initially started writing that suite back in 2000, I think late 2005, early 2006. And at the time, I was really obsessed with numbers, just the concept of numbers. I walk down the street and add up the numbers and license plates and phone numbers and just do it in my head and just not really notice, you know, the beautiful, you know, scenery around me. And so it really took me away from, you know, having close relationships with the people around me and things. And so I needed some kind of outlet to not do that kind of thing anymore. And so I looked towards the idea of composing, you know, a suite of music based on a completed Sudoku game. So I took a puzzle from, we have this newspaper here in Boston called the Boston Metro. You might have it in New York. Are you in New York?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a daily free newspaper that has a Sudoku game. So I completed it, and then I wrote this suite and came into some writer's block and everything. And so I kind of put it away for a while. And then I got a call from Dave Douglas to, he offered a commission for the Font Festival, the Festival of New Trumpet Music, the following year. And so then I picked it back up, and then I finished it. And then I premiered it in New York at the Standard. I think that was in 2007. It could be in 2006. I can't remember. And so that was a lot of fun to put together, and it kind of got me out of the OCD habit of adding license plate numbers together. And so it was pretty therapeutic for me to dive into that world. And so I did that, and we played the music down. And several years after that, I got the chance to record it on Steeple Chase. So I put it together and we put the record out.
Yeah. You've been playing at Wally's in Boston for how long now? Like almost 20 years, right?
Yeah, about 20. I've been playing there for 20. I've been I started just going to sit in, and then I started running the jam sessions at Wally's on Sundays. And I did that for, oh gee, I don't know, maybe 16, 17 years. And I've been doing Fridays and Saturdays for about 14, 15 years.
That's some kind of achievement to have a residency of that length. Like, how did that come about? How did you develop that relationship with the owner or whatever, you know, that allowed you to just kind of take that spot?
Yeah, it's you know, at that club, a lot of the nights they get handed down from the musicians. And so it's when I started going there, on Fridays and Saturdays, Jeremy Pelt would have a band, and then Darren Barrett would have a band, both great trumpet players, both mentors of mine. They were both playing and every night. And then on Saturdays, there were various people running the sessions. Then Wayne Escoffrey ran it for a bit, and Warren Wolf, we co-led it at some point. And they ended up all moving, or Darren, he just stopped playing there at one point. And so they handed the gig off to me because I had been there and I'd been sitting in a lot. And by that time, I had also been subbing for them. And so it was kind of a natural handing of the baton. So yeah, that's kind of how that happened. And I just ended up still there. So I don't know anybody my age who's played at one place for so long.
Yeah. And what does it allow you? Like, are you using it as a workshop to premiere new music, or are you there as like an entertainer playing standards and in sort of like a
No, we
crowd
play
pleasing mode? Like,
original music that tries to please the crowd, but you know, we can only do that to a certain extent, because that place, they don't charge a cover, so people don't necessarily come to hear music. They, you know, they want to come have a beer with their friends. But it's also a challenge it's a fun challenge to present new music to them and bring the energy to hopefully grab somebody's ear for a moment. So yeah, it's been a really, really, really helpful platform for me to bring in and test new music. but it's one thing because I'm performing against a palette of sound, so it's not conducive for me to, you know, bring in a set of ballads.
Right. Yeah.
At that place, but yeah, I've been able to really write and develop a repertoire of tunes that can work in that kind of space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you have pretty much a steady band? Do you bring in guests? You know, stuff like that. Like.
Yeah, I usually have a steady band, and I have a steady rotation of subs that play. You know, right now, I mean, I've been hiring a lot of young students that are really talented. And so, you know, some end up playing with me for their entire time while they're in school, and then they move to New York. And so within the past 15, 16 years I've been there, I've seen several generations of, you know, four-year college students come through and play in my band and then go on to, you know, do great things.
Yeah, yeah. And last year you said you did the two Live at Wally's albums. So, and that was yeah. That when you first started working with Jimmy Katz, because he recorded those and also shot the covers and stuff. So it was
that was the first time I connected with him for one of my own projects. But before that, I had been working with him via Noah's projects.
Uh huh.
Yeah, we had done, I think, two or three, maybe even four. I think we did a recording that didn't come out. So, yeah, I've been doing things with Noah for maybe a year and a half before we did the live stuff at Wally. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is he, what's he like as an engineer/producer? Is he hands-on, or does he just kind of set up the mics and let you go do your thing?
Oh, he does it all, yeah. I mean, he... For the Wally's thing, he came up, he and Dina Katz, they came up to Boston. They took a bus up. They brought their equipment on the bus. I couldn't believe it. It was absolutely insane what they did. And so, yeah, he came in, he brought in an AEA, nice AEA mic for the trumpet, one of the best mics you can ever think of, and set up a little rig on the side of the club. It's a really small club, Wally's is. Very, very small. Intimate set, but you know, he came and set up everything, threw the mics up, and we did a little sound check and everything, but he came up a couple of times before we actually recorded the stuff officially. He came and did some test runs.
Mm-hmm.
At Wally's, and so yeah, he's incredible to work with. He's got great ears, great approach, and great ears, and you know, it's great to volley ideas off of him and Dina, you know, just about sound and concept and things. So
yeah.
And then the photography side too is just, yeah, he's a legend. He's a Michael Jordan of jazz photography, you
know? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen his photos for years, you know. Yeah. All over the place. So, you starred in the movie Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. How did you How did you get that role? Did you know Damien Chazelle at Harvard or something? Like, what was the story?
No, I didn't know him. When he conceived that film, he wanted to have a drummer as the lead role initially. And so he went down to Wally's on a week, not on a night that I wasn't there, and he asked Lee Fish actually if he was interested, and I guess Lee said no. So Damien left, came back a couple of weeks later, and I was playing there, and he asked me if I wanted to do it, and I was like, sure, I'll give you my card. I didn't think anything of it, you know, I get those kind of requests a lot, and so I gave him my card, didn't think anything of it. Come Monday, he calls me and say, hey man, yeah, we met at Wally's, I want to shoot some scenes, maybe we can meet the other actors, and so that's how we started shooting scenes for that, and yeah, that was it. Just through Wally's, he came down to Wally's. He's a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
and so yeah, he came down, and we just started from there.
So what was the experience like overall? Did you have much interest in acting before that? Had you ever, you know, explored it at all?
Oh no, not at all. No interest at all. It was a fun experience. I guess it was very unconventional because there was no plot. I never read a script. All the dialogue was improvised. It's what they call a mumblecore type film. I guess that's a genre I'm familiar with. I don't know too much about it. But, yeah, everything was shot out of sequence. And so what we do is we come into a scene and he say, okay, Jason, this is what's going on today. This is how you're feeling. This is what happened between you and Madeline. And, you know, this is what you're going to say. Okay, so maybe talk about this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just going to hold the camera and shoot. So we have a little, I have an interaction with Madeline. And then he say, okay, good, cut. Okay, that was good. This was good. Say this, do that. You know, twist your body this way, do it. You know, blah, blah, blah. Okay, we'll shoot another scene. Okay, action, bam. So we do another scene, and that's usually what would end up in the movie. So everything was improvised in the very beginning, and then he kind of molded it from there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that was like a two-year process.
Wow.
For him to finish that. There was a big blip in time where he lost a lot of the footage in a processing accident that happened at a facility that processed the wrong type of film. So he lost a lot. So he had to recoup a lot to redo that one particular dance scene in the film.
Since then, there's been a lot of discussion in the jazz community. I mean, you know, as someone who's involved in the jazz community, you know how people love to talk, but you know, there's been some discussion about Damien's take on jazz. Like, some people don't even seem to think he actually likes the music based on how it was portrayed in, like, Whiplash and La La Land. So, I mean, having worked with the guy, what's your take on that?
You know, I haven't talked to him much about, you know, everyone else's perceived opinions of him. But, you know, I watched Whiplash. I came in with no preconceived notions, and I thought the movie was hilarious. For some reason, it was this dark comedy that just had me rolling. I don't know why, but you know, his opinions about it. And you know, if people are gonna play too much into it, you just wonder why I put that much energy into something that you don't really have control over. You know, I think he's been really fortunate to be able to do what he does. And to be really recognized for it, and I just hope he continues to help musicians in any kind of way he can. You know, because with a lot of the success he has, it comes a lot of responsibility. So, I actually hadn't even seen La La Land.
No,
I saw a little bit of it in a plane, but yeah, I don't really watch. I watch Whiplash on a plane. You know, I don't really watch movies and everything. So.
Yeah, yeah. So, tell me about this new record, because it's coming out. Actually, this interview will be coming out the same day the album does. So.
Oh, cool.
When Jimmy Katz came to you with the Giant Step Arts proposal, were you surprised? Like, was it a long discussion? What was the backstory?
Yeah, he called me and. He had this proposal about this organization he was putting together called Giant Step Arts, and I just thought, wow, this guy is an angel. You know, he and Dina, they've you know, done wonders for the community, the jazz community, up until now, you know, and with the Giant Step Arts organization, it's just brought it to another level. He approached me with the idea of, you know, putting together a project and me having, you know, more control than I would usually have, you know, if I was on Steeplechase or Crisscross or anything else, which is really surprising to me. You know, I almost didn't know what to think of it. I thought it was almost a prank call at one point, but you know, I knew he wasn't that kind of person to do that. So I was really humbled and honored that he would, think of me for this kind of project, and so kudos to Jimmy and Dina and all the whole team for getting the ball rolling with this organization. It's a really innovative, one of a kind organization. I don't know of any other organizations that are doing what what they're doing with this organization. But he called me in, and I, you know, I've been having an itch to write a lot, and so it gave me a lot of initiative to really, really write, and to get more serious about writing for a particular ensemble. It's kind of like when I was doing the Sudoku thing, you know, having that commission kind of helped me complete the work that I was working on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, when he called for that, yeah, I was really pumped to start writing. And so when I started writing, I just felt like it wasn't flowing as often as it did. And oddly enough, I started doing intermittent fasting. And that helped me finish writing the music that ended up on the record, the very new tunes that ended up on the record.
So how much of this stuff was written specifically for this album, and how much of it was like tunes that had been in the live book or, you know, things like that?
Yeah, there were only three of the tunes had been played before, but not much before. Satana, Blue Grotto, and Kalispell Bay was a pretty new tune. I wrote that back in January, January of 2018. And so yeah, everything else was specifically written with those players in mind. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there one composition that's kind of the key to the record where once you wrote it, you were like, okay, now I know what kind of album I'm making, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, you know, I'd say the first tune on the record, Herbs in the Glass, was the most conceptual idea that kind of envelops the spirit of the record, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it took influences from multiple people to write that tune in particular. I was checking out a lot of Robert Glasper and Herbie Hancock, so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's where it's kind of a play on words, the title.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because that you mentioned two keyboardists, though, because it's a non-keyboard band.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
So yeah. Why did you choose the players that you did, Mark Turner and Matt Brewer and Kendrick Scott? What about those guys were the right voices for this record?
Yeah, I was. I'm really close with all three of them, just in different capacities. Kendrick, we played a lot when he was in Boston. He played it while he was with me for a long time, for a couple of years. And Matt Brewer, I played in Greg Osby's band with him for about 2 years, and also taught at a camp with he and his father in Michigan for every year for about 5 or 6 years.
Oh,
and then
who's his father?
His father's Paul Brewer. He's a great trombonist, great educator in Michigan, Grand Rapids.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot from him, too. Yeah, he's very, very knowledgeable, deep well of musical knowledge. He and his wife, Robin, they're wonderful people. And then Mark Turner, yeah, I've been working with him for the past, I don't know how many years, 3-4 years. And so I just really wanted to get those four together and do a chordless record. And yeah, it's my first chordless recording, live recording.
Mm-hmm. And so how did that change the way you write, like in terms of shaping the compositions and stuff, knowing that it's going to be more sort of melody based and things like that?
Yeah, it gave me, you know, knowing how well Mark plays and reads and prepares for sessions, it made it pretty easy for me to write more challenging counterpoint between what the bass and trumpet do on a lot of the melodies. And so it kind of filled out the orchestrative, you know, vibe of most of the tunes. So I had more to work with, knowing that Mark and Matt are such great, you know, readers and interpreters of anything that I would ever write. So, and I also didn't want it to be too inhibited by a chordal instrument for this particular project. So, because I know Matt, he is double stops, and you know everything that he plays on the bass is just so rich and full of harmony. Anyway, he really has a way of making multiple notes ring out on the bass that gives it this extra harmonic flavor. That's wonderful. So. And Kendrick's so melodic on drums too. He has the way he tunes his drums is just magic in itself too. So he's got another harmonic thing going on the drum set, and just his whole setup. You know, he'll put a hi-hat Fox cymbal stand. He put a little, he had a snare drum on the floor, and it was hooked up to a pedal. So he was playing an auxiliary snare on the floor. Just those little things just kind of give the record a really cool vibe.
Yeah, yeah. And did you know all along that it was going to be a double disc?
Yeah. I timed everything, and that was the plan for it to be a double disc.
Because that's another whole sort of writing challenge, is if you're presenting that much material to kind of maintain variety as it goes along, you know?
Yeah. And, I mean, I had so much material, I had to kind of whittle down what I was going to present too. And I just knew I wanted to feature certain players on certain songs, and I kind of had an idea of how their improvisations would have an arc and how long that would take. And so I kind of did the math in my head to know that to play those 8 songs, they won't fit on one record. So I would have to stretch a few of them and keep a few of them short and stuff. So.
Yeah. And were they, because it's a live recording from the Jazz Gallery, so I mean, they pretty much performed in sequence, or did you resequence it after, or anything else like that?
Oh, yeah. We resequenced everything. We did it over 2 nights. And a lot of the takes that ended up on the record were the second night. And I kind of naturally knew that would probably happen, because we weren't a working band at the time. We hadn't played together that much as a group outside of the rehearsal. We did a rehearsal the day before, and I had sent them the music, and I had tested the music at Wally's a couple of weeks before. So I played it, and I knew what it sounded like, but it's totally different when you bring it for the first time. So it was still fresh to them, so. Yeah, everything was put together in a different sequence.
And was it announced as a live recording session for the club?
Yeah, for Giant Steps.
Like people that came to the gig knew that it was being recorded and stuff like that?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And was what's your take on playing the gallery generally? Do you like playing there?
That place is. It's a godsend. It's probably my favorite place to play in New York. That place in the Vanguard. My absolute favorite places. Rio, Dale when he was alive, and they're all wonderful folks. The one club that actually offered me a gig there as a leader. So really, really fortunate to Rio and her. Very openness to allow me to present there for that project, and all the other gigs I've done there in the past. Actually, when Guy and Madeline premiered at the Tribeca Festival, I was playing at the gallery the same night, and so when they premiered at the gallery, at the festival, I walked the red carpet. I had my trumpet in my hand. I played a little bit. And then right before the movie showed on the screen, I went down to the front of the theater and said hello to everybody. And I invited them all over to the gallery after the film was over, because it was pretty close to the gallery. And so a few people came from the premiere of the movie,
nice.
Which was pretty funny.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So that's kind of a
it's
connection.
Like, wow, this guy's actually a musician, you know, not just an actor playing a musician.
Yeah. That was fun.
Yeah. So the do you feel like, because obviously you have a profile in Boston, so I mean, is it, do you still get the feeling of being the guy from out of town when you play New York?
Never. Mm-mm. You know, I know more people in New York than I do up here. Like most of my friends, when I go down to New York, it's like a reunion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Especially when I hang out at the clubs, I always see people I haven't seen in a while. It's like catching up. So I don't necessarily think it's like being out of town. It's just like seeing people I hadn't seen in a while. And you never really feel like time has been lost that much because we're so connected on social media and everything too. So
yeah.
So you kind of keep up with people to a degree, but just actually seeing people face to face is pretty cool.
Yeah. So the I know because I've talked to Jimmy about this that part of the whole Giant Step Arts deal is that the distribution and sales of this record are all up to you. They just kind of hand it off to you. So
yep. Mm-hmm.
How are you handling that? Like, where and how will people be able to buy this album? And will it be available on Spotify and streaming services and stuff like that? Like,
yeah, I just finished my CD Baby. I've created a profile and everything. And after I get off the phone with you, I'm sending my CDs to CD Baby.
Ah, okay.
So I'll be selling them through there, and then I'll look into the streaming side of it.
Yeah.
Probably when I get back from, I'm doing a tour with Mark starting next week.
Oh, where are you guys going?
We're going to be in Europe for 2 weeks.
Nice, nice. I think CD Baby actually handles that stuff. Like, I think they actually will do it for you, make sure it gets up on Spotify and Apple Music and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, I'll probably do that.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah. Well, so my goal is to have that ready by. I hope they have the CDs by the first.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been sending them out. Some people have sent me PayPals. I've gotten a few email, like personal emails of people who wanted one. So I sent out a few last week. Just personally, but I'm going to have CD Baby take care of it from March 1st on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that was my interview with Jason Palmer, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Visit OsirisPod.com to learn about other Osiris programs, and visit Patreon.com/Burning Ambulance to become a subscriber and support this program for just $5 a month. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Osiris.